So welcome to the Food Leaders Interview from FrogUp, where we talk to owners, leaders and influencers in the food and drink industry. Fudge Kitchen has been producing small batch artisan confectionery for a staggering 40 years now, with their own shops, wholesale, white label and e-commerce channels offering premium fudges, caramels, brittles and barks. With a personal touch, the business continues to delight its customers and bring new products to market. Today's guest is MD Richard Parson, who follows in the footsteps of founder Sian Holt. Richard is committed to creating show-stopping products that make a positive impact on people's lives and make the world a better place as an employee-owned business. I'm looking forward to finding out all about it. Welcome, Richard.
Hi, Stephen. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us how and when you joined Fudge Kitchen and I guess what your priorities are for the business?
So, interesting journey. I joined Fudge Kitchen in January of 2020, so not a massive amount of time. I'm actually considered a bit of a newbie amongst the team, but yeah, joined literally the first week of January 2020. A couple of months in, it was a completely different world. So my plans, you know, what I went into the interview saying, this is what I can help with the business and what we can do, was very different 2 months in. I formerly had worked in a few different industries, mostly kind of tech, security, very different. and then kind of was looking for a business with a bit more story that produced something. I think food is so emotive and you just don't get the same kind of satisfaction in tech. Blockchain isn't tasty.
I was going to say people don't love blockchain, but I'm sure some people do love blockchain.
Some people really love it.
And what's kind of your focus? Is operations or marketing or sales?
So marketing background. Yeah, so I joined the company as a marketing manager. And what I've come to learn is that there's been quite a few very different marketing managers that preceded me that had very different takes. I joined at a point in time where the company was expanding on social media and trying to reach, not, you know, relying on our historic gifting business and the customers who come to us looking to send sentiments, but instead trying to capture the impulse purchase and try and bring a new generation to Fudge Kitchen.
And you sell through, I mean, you've got six of your own shops. Is that something the business has always had or is that more recent?
So the original business came, it was an American guy called Jim Garrahy. He bought the business to the UK in the early 80s and started in theme parks initially. And Sian Holt took the business over in the mid 90s and created Fudge Kitchen what it is today and positioned our shops in historic cathedral cities, aimed, you know, lots of tourist customers, but also university towns. You got lots of affluent locals. A lot of our customers are tourists, but we have some like kind of really hardcore local fans as well. But we've always been in historic cities. And at the moment, our furthest north is in Scotland, on the streets of Edinburgh, all right down to the Abbey Churchyard in Bath.
Yes, I can see the profile of the cities you're in. So Fudge Kitchen has been in business for 40 years. What's kind of stayed the same? What are the kind of core things? And what's changed in that time? And maybe what's changed more recently? I guess COVID's probably a bit of a pivot point.
Yeah, COVID absolutely was. Because again, I think I mentioned I'm a relative newbie. There are people in the business who've been with us for 30 plus years. Those people can tell you stories of way back when in the early days. But there's a founding principle in the business, which is to keep it clean and be nice to people, which are pretty good things, we think. We still produce all of our fudge following an original recipe from the 1830s, because that's how fudge was made. And we've tweaked it over the years, but we've moved with the times in terms of flavors and making products that adapt to new tastes. And we're continually looking forward. But there's a lot of heritage in the business, which is one of the reasons why I was drawn to kind of join the team. Those things don't really change. Those things do stay the same. And I think we value them staying the same. COVID was a challenging period, but it was a massive opportunity for us to have a look at the core principles of the business and making sure that, you know, when customers weren't able to walk over the threshold of your shops and try your fudge before they buy it, how do you sell our product and how do you grow the business to customers who've never heard of us? purely online. And those challenges, I think we tackled them in a pretty efficient way, and we came out of COVID stronger than I think we ever had been as a business.
I mean, I speak to a lot of people on here, and they got a sales spike from COVID because they really went for e-commerce, especially if it was a sort of indulgent, a treaty kind of thing. Has that e-commerce spike sustained, or has it kind of normalized a bit, or?
We often see a bit of a seesaw when online does really well. The shops are probably going through a pretty quiet period. It's been like that forever. During COVID, we saw sales spikes of up to 1,000%. It was ludicrous, really, and that's just on our e-com side. On our wholesale side of the business, our historic, our kind of core customer, who are luxury department stores, and hoteliers, they obviously struggled quite significantly, but we pivoted our production to be able to provide for hamper companies and online gifting companies, and we had a record year. You definitely saw a drop off post-COVID, but we had shifted how the business worked at the time, and we've definitely grown post-COVID and are continuing to grow it.
Can you just outline what's kind of in the range and maybe highlight some of the newer products you've got?
Yeah, so we kind of have three types of products. Our stores make a traditional slab fudge, which is made the old-fashioned way.
Oh, stores actually manufacture as well.
On site every day. Yeah, if you visit a shop, I mean, to be honest, you'll probably be pushed over the threshold by someone on the outside who will be welcoming you in.
The smell of hot fudge.
Yeah, and then we make the majority of the product they sell is made on site every single day, fresh. It's the old time-tested method, copper cauldrons, Carrara marble tables. They make it in front of you, in full view. You can do a fudge-making experience and have a go yourself in store, in all of our stores across the country. And you can sample anything. But that is our kind of core iconic product. We make the fudge in long kind of baguettes. It's poured onto the table, worked, and then folded into a long baguette, and then it's sold by the slice or in boxes, literally the old-fashioned way. You can also buy from them artisan butter fudge. We call it that because the traditional slab fudge is literally sugar cream, the natural flavorings that we use for the flavor, and that's it. There is no preservatives in it. It is whipped into shape. It has a shelf life of around 14 days, meaning the product isn't really suitable for wholesale. So we developed about 13 years ago a different recipe that adds a little bit of butter to keep the fat content and extend the shelf life of the product. And our artisan butter fudge has got a shelf life of around 7 to 8 months. But again, there are no preservatives in it other than the butter and sugar. But it is still made by an artisan team, many of whom started their kind of careers in a fudge shop, moved to help establish this production kitchen, which is in the heart of Kent, our home county, just outside of Canterbury. And that product is kind of cut, hand decorated, and put into gift boxes, mostly sold under our own name to retailers like John Lewis and Selfridges. And then we do quite a lot of white label. Yeah, the artisan butter fudge product is aimed predominantly at a gifting market. And the product that is sold in department stores and used in in-room gifting for hoteliers can also be found on the shelves of specialty independent retailers like farm shops, delis, all throughout the UK. That product is also exported a little bit. We do a little bit of export in Canada, Central Europe, and tiny bit in the Middle East. But again, it's a very clean product. So the lack of preservatives does pose us a kind of slight, we can't go too far with it, but it's about quality more than anything. And then in addition, we have kind of a classic confectionery range. We make hand-stretched brittles, barks, chocolate-coated caramels, coconut ice, chocolate-coated honeycomb, which is my favorite product we make, and a traditional crumbly fudge, so it's distinct from our other two types of fudge. most of those products have now launched in a brand new range that we only announced last week, in a new kind of A-frame box format aimed at the specialty independent market.
Is that where the innovation is and the kind of that new product development? Is it in the flavor or?
We kind of split out new product development and product design as two different areas of the business because we're sitting on 300 recipes plus just in the production kitchen side. The shops, you can create to your heart's content, really. They are practically a zero food waste business in a sense that anything that they test, they can recook into other flavors. They're very hot on allergens and maintaining, the kind of the safety of food, but they do play quite a lot. And the fudge format that we have is very, very versatile. We can deliver flavor on the more production side of things. We can deliver flavors very, very quickly. There's not a lot that they haven't really done in those kitchens. And our inspiration comes partly from the shop teams who will try stuff and then we will take it into a bit more of a controlled environment and test it and try it there. But we also work very, very closely with a lot of our key customers in the luxury retail space who come to us specifically because they know that we have the means to make their dreams come true when it comes to confectionery. But when we are kind of approaching the development of new flavors, we always start with some key production principles, which is that the products must be, the ingredients must be all natural. There must be handmade elements to it. We cannot use preservatives. It must be gluten-free and vegetarian. And we never steer away from those requirements.
And do you do sort of customer testing or focus groups, or how do those new ideas kind of come to you?
The shop teams sample their flavors every single day. So we get a lot of customer feedback on which flavors they do and don't like. Every year we have a big competition called New Year, New Flavor, which is actually taking place in about 2-3 weeks' time, where our shop teams, we kind of give them a brief based on consumer trends and things that we see coming up. And then each shop team has to develop two recipes that have to meet all of these very strict requirements, and they send them to our production kitchen. And then we usually invite other food founders and producers. We're very lucky in Kent that we have a great kind of food community of producers, and we invite them to our production kitchens and then we taste test them. To the winning flavors will end up being put into production throughout the year. On the kind of wholesale side, we don't really do much consumer testing, but it's a bit of a two-way street in the relationships that we have with many of our customers, in that they come to visit us, we go to visit them, and we have a look at what their customers are asking for. Many of them, it might not be actual taste testing, but they have access to, customer data, what questions they're asking, what they're looking for, and they come to us with those questions, and we'll develop them and see how they fit with the other food and drink flavor profiles that they have to come up with something that will work. And I guess one of the biggest kind of results of consumer testing is when you get 5 more orders for it. And we can usually tell in advance because we have the consumer feedback from our own retail side.
Well, at what stage did the shops come into the mix? I think it's really interesting that the shop is producing and testing and innovating and bringing ideas in, obviously getting customer feedback. I was going to say there's an overhead to having shops, but I guess if they've always been part of the business, then not an overhead, is it?
No, the shops are kind of the original. It's the OG business, really.
Oh, because of the theme park thing.
Yeah, so the shops, we've had Fudge Kitchen, the retail element was started in the early 80s. The wholesale and the production kitchen wasn't opened until 2013. So it's kind of, that's our bread and butter. Each part of the business brings very different types of value overall. And the high street is an interesting one, but I think that we've shown that we've bucked the trend of certain high streets. So we're very lucky that we're right in the heart of some of the UK's top, destinations, and also we're not just offering a retail shop, but an experience that you say you walk in, you smell this. It's a absolute kind of sense overload, the taste, the smell, the visuals, because it's all made right in front of you. You can taste it. It brings people back time and time again. And, you consult TripAdvisor, and before they changed it, that we now fall under on TripAdvisor, we now fall underneath food outlets, but we used to be under things to do. Our shop in Windsor is higher than Windsor Castle. things to do in Windsor. We're in the top two of things to do in most of the cities. It will be like, York Minster Fudge Kitchen.
Once you've done the Minster, go and get some fudge. And it's really, I was thinking it's really interesting is if it was a food business to have that ability to get to be close to the customer, the end customer. I think that is a huge value, but it would probably be quite prohibitive for most. If you started as direct to consumer and some wholesale, it might be quite prohibitive to open those shops.
Yeah, I think we're often asked a question about, the value of vertical integration and the fact that we can see, we are retailers, wholesalers, producers, manufacturers, we're all of them. So it's a lot to do. So when I joined the business marketing manager and I was like, oh yeah, here's a retail business. They're like, oh yeah, but you've also got e-commerce and you've got, I was like, oh okay, this is a 5-person job. I get it. It's never boring. And I think that actually it's always driven us because we have the information at our fingertips all the time. And the retail business for us, because we're producing on site, it can be its own element. I think if we decided to open a retail shop from out again, we absolutely believe and love our wholesale product. But if we decided to open a retail shop that just sold that product without the added element of it's produced on site, you can see it being made, you can taste it off the table as soon as it's been produced, it's a very different element. And so our products are tailored on that side of the business to be suitable for the environments where we expect it to be. Because again, some of our largest customers don't even have retail locations. They are purely online. And so our products need to be tailored to the way it's sold online. So, which is very, very different to the way it's sold in store for us versus how it's sold in store in, a luxury department store like Selfridges.
One thing I did notice looking through the website is you're committed to do a pretty significant number of shows and events as every month, as well as all those other channels.
Again, it kind of goes back a bit to the beginning when we first opened our shops, again, because they opened in theme parks. And then when we started to close down the theme park locations and move into cities, we started to do a load of country fairs and, we do the Great Yorkshire Show and things like that. And then over the years, it grew and grew and grew. I think with the consumer shows, it's an opportunity to meet people from all walks of life all across the country, especially in areas where we don't necessarily have a shop. That's like quite important. And we, to be honest, I think that even if the shops, sorry, if the shows were not huge revenue generators, we'd still do it because, again, some of the shows we've been doing since the first one, like some of the, Spirit of Christmas show, I think we've been doing that since its inception. And we have like a very small shows team who plan them out a year, like a whole year in advance. We choose the right ones at the right time. And it's kind of all spearheaded by one guy who's been with the business for 37 years. He's been here since the beginning. And he's almost an institution in himself, really. People go to the show and expect to see him there, and they're devastated if they can't find us. That's obviously on the more consumer side, but I think on the trade show side, we don't always have the opportunity to let wholesale customers taste the product before they buy it. We're no stranger to the fact that our product is handmade, which means it is slightly more expensive. And if you're speaking to an independent retailer who, is dealing with all the changes happening with business, that sometimes they might not want to have to. They won't consider paying a little bit more for their fudge. But for us, we can tell them, if you're if you want to operate responsibly and sustainability with sustainability in mind, then you can have faith that our product not only meets all those criteria, but is also really tasty. And it's an opportunity for us to get in front of prospective customers. And we also work directly with most of our customers. We don't operate with many distributors. It is direct to consumer. We introduced a wholesale site, allowing them to place orders very quickly without having to pick up the phone and go through all the rigmarole of that. And so it's an opportunity for them to meet Mark, our business development manager, and get to know the team and who, they're going to have a direct relationship with them. And the value in it is for us to explain that we're not mass producing this. We understand what it's like to be a smaller business. We still are, it's personable, really.
That makes me think, how big is the business in terms of people?
So we're around 70 staff nationally, including the shop staff, the production kitchen, and our kind of support HQ team. Because again, I'm still a bit of a newbie. I've only been here for 5 years, which is nothing, which is a blink in Fudge Kitchen time. I hear stories of how the office was originally run in a loft somewhere in someone's house. But it's still gradually growing. We are on the lookout to continue to expand our retail stores. We had 7 stores before the pandemic, and sadly, we lost our shop in Oxford because the building we were in was sold. And so we're on the lookout to replace that location. And we've scoped about 4 or 5 other locations across the UK. So we are fully intending to continue the growth of the retail element as well as the wholesale arm as well.
As you say, I think you said before about bucking the trend for a lot of things. That sounds like very much bucking the trend. That's really exciting to be in that position.
Yeah, the shop. I mean, again, after the pandemic, we had one of our best retail years ever in store, and they continue to grow year on year in sales. For a lot of people, a lot of customers, you were kind of demanding more for your money. And I think that it's one of the things that Fudge Kitchen does very, very well, in that you can visit a store and it's not just to come and buy some, not inexpensive fudge, but the teams are outstanding when it comes to like customer service. I mean, all of our reviews are, I would give these guys 6 stars if I could. I've literally never met someone nicer. Fudge Kitchen is one of those family businesses without much of the dysfunction of a family business. Because I know that's a term that's a little bit polarizing, calling a business a family business.
Yeah, it depends how you're brought up, I suppose, doesn't it?
But it is it does buck that trend, especially as an employee-owned business as well.
At what point did that happen? Why did it happen? And what does it mean in kind of how you experience the business?
Yeah, so it was a fairly recent change. You mentioned Sian Holt, who we refer to as the company's founder because she kind of made it what it is today, and she was, very well known in the kind of food and drink sector. Absolute kind of icon, really, who led the business for 40 years. She announced that the business would become employee-owned in 2022. She was considering what her exit from the business would look like. And because we're quite an interesting business with a retail element, an e-commerce business, a wholesale element, and a kind of private label part of that, a sale of the business or a management buyout just wasn't on the cards without causing friction or people likely to, lose jobs down the line. So ultimately, the idea was that we would become an employee-owned trust where all of the staff are beneficiaries, and then over many years, we would basically pay back the value of the business. And then continue to run the business for the benefit of the employees rather than shareholders. Great, brilliant. Sian made the announcement in 2022, and I think it was all about the people. We've always been a people-first business, and that method of her exiting the business, I think we all felt very grateful for it. Unfortunately, a month later, she fell ill, quite suddenly, and was it, there was the plan was for her to have a 2-year transition to the end of 2024, where she would pick a successor and we would transition through all the things you have to do. Unfortunately, that wasn't able to happen. But I think on the, but then we managed to very quickly kick into gear. And I mean, she was the kind of person who spun all the plates. She was involved in everything. Most people would tell you the business was her third child. Like many founders, it's, you know, it almost felt like a kind of, right, okay, everyone, we need to, you know, let's learn how to do this ourselves very, very quickly. And we're still here, which is great. We still do almost everything, constantly asking her, what would Sian do? Because the culture of the business was built by her, adopted and run with by everyone else. And going forward, it is quite nice because you've got a lot of staff members who actively benefit. You know, a portion of the profits from the business is distributed amongst the staff. The better we do, the more there is available. It doesn't go to shareholders. It's yeah, it's incentivizing.
And you mentioned B Corp, which you're working towards. What does that give you above and beyond being employee owned? Because there's quite an overlap, I guess.
B Corp accreditation for us, it's not just a network of sustainable businesses that you can work with. It is a kind of, for us, it's a sign of commitment to transparency and being held accountable more than anything. During COVID, or just after the pandemic, when we were reviewing all of our sustainable measures, we changed sugar suppliers. All of our sugar is UK grown beet sugar. So, you know, and that was made because not only of a carbon impact, but human rights implications, you know, in cane sugar production. We also changed our chocolate. Again, you can't grow cocoa in Kent, unfortunately.
Sure, there's someone trying somewhere.
I'm sure. But it was more about, you know, it's a human rights issue. And we work with a farmer-owned chocolate producer now, in Colombia specifically. Dairy, local packaging, UK printed, plant-based inks, water-based goods, every element of the supply chain had to be reviewed. And we were talking to lots of different producers, and they were saying, well, why are you not talking about this and going out there and saying it? I said, because many businesses of our size in particular, you would have to put someone on the staff just to deal with, you know, just to quantify it. And they'd have to go to someone who specifically looks after our energy. They'd have to drop everything to kind of get that together. And I said, the problem is that, especially with the Competitions and Markets Authority crackdown on the Green Claims Code, businesses were struggling. You know, you don't want to say something and be accused of greenwashing because you can't quantify it. And there was an issue, and there still is now, of businesses who are operating really sustainably without impacting the quality of their product. But they don't want to share how they're doing it or where they're doing it, because the minute you say, oh, I'm a model for other businesses, and you don't have the numbers and figures to back it up, that's a problem. And I think that with B Corp, it's a very transparent framework. And you can't hold all businesses to different, you know, to the same criteria, but it's a points-based system that's quite good. I mean, there are others out there, but for us is the most stringent. And it doesn't just say, oh, you know what, you did a really good job, tick, you're fine. You have to show continual development, and you have to show that you are not resting on your laurels. And it's the ethos of that that we really like, and we wanted to be held accountable by someone else. We changed our articles of incorporation to say that we will make these changes, and the sign of approval is a nice thing, and it's, you know, to catch someone's attention, but actually it's all the work underneath that, which is confidence building. And there are many accreditations out there that I think are akin to greenwashing, whereas for us, we kind of want someone to hold us accountable.
So I noticed on the website you were very proud of your sort of ability to personalize the product. How important is that to customers, and is that something that's available online as well as in stores, or vice versa?
Yeah, personalization has there's different meanings for different people. For us, I think online personalization is, many people are coming to our e-commerce site to buy gifts for people. And it's about having, we consider our boxes to effectively be gift boxes in themselves. We put a lot of effort into packaging, into our packaging in-house. We have a brilliant team in-house who look after all of that. And we make fudge. That's fundamentally what we do. We make different flavors of fudge, and we will tailor specific flavors available, you know, available for holidays. We'll have Easter flavors, we'll have flavors for Valentine's Day. And if you're sending a gift, you don't have to wrap it all up once you've received it. So we will offer specific flavors. I think customization of the flavors available. I think you'd have anarchy if we just had set boxes, because there are people who will buy a whole box of one flavor like that we see regularly, which is fine. all the power to them. I would be the same. Then we offer different customization options through stickers, boxes, elements to show sentiment. Get well soon, happy birthday, happy Mother's Day. Some holidays and prime gifting periods work better for fudge. We've always fundamentally been a gifting business since the beginning. And it has driven us to be a bit more innovative around those peak gifting periods, because holidays like Valentine's Day and Easter are dominated by chocolate. So we're playing in someone else's garden, really. But it means that we have to come up with flavors or formats that will, you know, compete. We've worked out where fudge sits in the gift market and all the unique challenges that go with it, because it isn't chocolate, it isn't alcohol. It's a very interesting product format.
Is there anything you wish you could go back and tell, anything you know now that you wish you could go and tell yourself at some point in the last 5 years that would have saved pain, missed opportunity?
I think for a business of this age and the processes, I think if 5 years ago, I think it would have been, because again, I joined the business in a marketing capacity, and I find marketing people are expected to be the most altruistic looking, you know, like reaching for the stars. But many of them are also the most pessimistic, because they have to find a return. So you're kind of expected to do all these amazing things, and all the time you're kind of Scrooge to your own projects. And then I went from a marketing role into the role of MD. And I kind of thought, what I've kind of looked at now is, the one piece of advice would be to look at how the nuts and bolts of it work. All the tiny little details, because I mean, I'm the kind of person who will bug everyone with questions. I want to know how everything works. And I'm like, what does that molecule do in that particular ingredient to make that happen? And they're like, Christ, you know. But I think it is little things like pricing you set on shipping, all the little tiny elements in the business. And I think you set these particular things up. Oh, we're going to charge X amount. And then you let it run for years and years and you tweak it every now and then. But actually, it tells a really interesting story, because, you know, we had our discussion yesterday about setting shipping pricing, and it all came out of, you know, but we were selling a very specific product at the time to a very specific customer at the time. And I think there's little things that seem not even relevant to a discussion about the launch of a new product can very, very quickly be overlooked. And I think for business leaders or founders, probably have your eyes on the ball the minute you start your business, or you're working with it. And then over time, you kind of step away and have a look. You know, you're not too involved on it. But sometimes that minutia just needs to be checked, I think, more than anything, because it tells your customers need to have confidence in you. And if you've overlooked something, it shows that you've not done the legwork for them, and that you're not as familiar with their problems, maybe as much as you think you are. It's not a great soundbite, but I think it is. Those little things, they all add up.
Obviously, you can't spend all your time obsessing about what the customer thinks, but you need to do it enough.
Yeah, I think if you know, I think if you come up with a product and you've identified a niche in the market, you've identified a product, and you're like, great, we're going to do this, it's going to be incredible, and then it turns out they're not really looking where you're selling it, you've set up barriers along your kind of conversion channel without even realizing it. I think it's really understanding feet on the ground. And that's why the value of putting the time and effort in to talk to lots of different customers is great, and understanding it, understanding the problems they're facing, because a marketing channel could have 30, 40 different subsets inside it, for the different price points, different demographics, different sectors. And it is about kind of understanding the nuts and bolts of things, not just from the customer's perspective, but also internally for your own staff and team, understanding where they need support, and making sure that they are not inadvertently turning people away without even knowing it. Comes back to that accountability thing, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, brilliant. What are the kind of key things you want to see the business doing in the next 3, 5 years, something like that?
Definitely expand the retail business further because it is the core of what we do and we love it. It's good fun. We definitely want to reopen shops in Oxford. We're looking to completely different counties. We would love to have our first shop in London. On our kind of production side, we're looking at brand new recipes, working more closely with our retail partners, and really drilling down into further developing our recipes. Our product is time tested. It's brilliant. And we've turned away prospects in the past purely because they don't operate as sustainably as we do, or because we would never agree to launch a product we weren't 100% sound was going to have the shelf life as promised and was going to be as good the day a customer opens it, even if it's on the last day of its shelf life, to the day it left our kitchens. So we're doing quite a lot of experimentation around shelf life extension of our product, using all natural ingredients, no artificial preservatives, no unsustainable but natural preservatives. So that's a big project for us, and we've got a brilliant team who are looking into that to open up markets who are asking to have our product. We're kind of extending it to them, and also identify new formats. Fudge is fudge. It's people know what to expect with it, but it's identifying what we can do with a product that's already loved, but tailor it to fit into alternative formats going forward. There's a lot going on.
Well, it's been really interesting to find out about it. It sounds like a fascinating business. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for talking to me, Stephen.
If you want to find out more about Fudge Kitchen, find stockists or order online, go to fudgekitchen.co.uk, and they have shops in York, Bath, should I say, Windsor, Canterbury, Cambridge, and Edinburgh. You can find out more about FrogHop's new product development support services at froghop.co.uk. If you want to listen to some previous Food Founders interviews and get some inspiration, go to froghop.co.uk/podcast or search for Food Founders interviews wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we're doing, please follow us or even give us a review. It all helps. Thanks for joining us and see you soon.